From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. Listen, for many years now, this show has completely been ignoring our listeners' taste, preferences, or good judgment. And frankly, it's worked out pretty well.
But that, Peter, ends today. This week, you, the listener, get to produce our show. Although you are limited by your raw materials, mainly us.
We asked you all to submit your favorite Wait, Wait moments for the last few years. What follows this hour is the result. Everybody wins. You get to hear the stuff you like best. We get to take the week off.
And we begin with the single most nominated Wait, Wait moment. It happened during a show we taped in Seattle in June of 2008 with panelists Paula Poundstone, Paul Provenza, and Adam Felber.
Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi.
Hi, who's this?
I'm Paula Ewing. I'm calling from Denver.
Hey, how are things in Denver?
Beautiful. Hot.
Hot, really? Wow.
Yeah.
So the ski season is finally over.
Yes.
Molly, it's nice to have you with us. You're going to play Who's Carl this time. Carl Castle, once again, will read three quotes from the week's news. If you correctly identify or explain two of them, you win our prize. Ready to go?
Yes.
All right, here's your first quote.
Disappointed, backwards, unusable, totally confusing, pathetic, completely odd, weird, scary, slow, garbage, not usable, crapped up, crap, absolute mess, craziness, terrible.
According to Mac Daily News, those were just some of the highlights from a long flame email a couple of years back. It was describing the writer's experience using Microsoft Windows. In fact, this week, the author of the email got so frustrated he quit Microsoft completely. Who was it?
Bill Gates?
Yes, Bill Gates. This week, more than 30 years after he founded Microsoft, Bill Gates officially turns in his badge and cleans out his cubicle. He's now going to go try to make something of his life. Gates' departure from the software behemoth is not expected to result in any huge changes at Microsoft. They will still be an implacable force for evil. But on the occasion of his departure, some people found this 2003 email. It was revealed in some court documents from the antitrust case. In it, Gates complains at great length with the most bitter frustration and anger, much like any of his customers, about his experience trying to use the Microsoft website to download software. Gates said, quote, "This site is so slow, it is unusable." Others pointed to his even more angry 1999 memo titled simply, "Clippy Must Die."
I've seen that video, them putting Clippy in a car. Hey, where are we going?
Who's Clippy?
One day, the engineers at Microsoft said, you know, the people using our products, they're frustrated, they're angry, but they're not insane with rage. How can we
focus their rage?
How about if just in the middle of doing something, an animated paperclip pops up on the screen and says, can I help you? What are you doing? Oh, can I see?
Jeez, there's a lot of trees out here. Tell don't think we're anywhere near Redmond anymore.
What is that, cannoli?
What are you digging? What are you digging? Can I help you dig? No. Oh, you got a baseball bat. Do you want to learn how to play baseball? Maybe I can help you with that.
It looks like you're digging a grave. Is this a business grave or a personal grave?
So he's an animated character that you didn't like?
Yeah, yeah. Basically. We'll explain later.
You folks must love technology because many of you asked to hear this moment from that same show in Seattle.
Paula, perhaps a solution for our latest energy crisis, Slate magazine published a scientific inquiry that seeks to prove that in the future, women will be able to power their iPods and other devices by harnessing the power of what?
Oh, my. By harnessing the power of, I don't know, jiggling fat comes to my mind.
So close.
Jiggling, yes. Fat, no.
Breasts?
Yes.
No!
Writer.
Wait a minute, is it just women or fat men, too?
Well, who knows how far the technology may go.
So already girls who feel inadequate...
now can't even watch TV.
Right, exactly. This is what I'm thinking.
They'll just have to listen to shorter songs.
Hey,
but the big girls will get to hear, like, symphonies. And
someday high school boys will leer at a girl and say, she could power Anna Gatti. See that girl over there? Couldn't get through Twinkle Twinkle.
Should I explain this or just...
Oh, yeah,
I'm going to explain this.
Yeah.
Writer Adrienne So. Her name is Adrienne So. She's writing in Slate. She says, quote, I've always found the concept of breasts bothersome. They will fulfill their intended function for about 3 of the 70 years that I have them. The rest of the time, they alternate between getting in my way and embarrassing me, unquote. So she decided to see if they could be put to some useful work. She talked to engineers who are working on ways to harness motion and generate energy.
I just want to see the patent that these guys have written out.
Ms. So discovered that in theory, you could construct a bra that captures the otherwise wasted energy of bouncing breasts and convert it into electricity to power personal devices, cell phones, iPods.
Pamela, that's not a stupid idea.
If you're Pamela Anderson, the nation of Columbia. Many of our stories, particularly in our Listener Limerick Challenge, rely on scientific studies. In November of 2008, Paula Poundstone had enough. And apparently so had you, because you wanted to hear this again. Here's Paula, along with panelists Adam Felber and Roxanne Roberts. Paula, a British psychologist, has determined that the best way for a man to attract a woman at a nightclub is to do what?
Show her money.
Actually, flash the cash.
Yes.
No. In order to do this correctly, one must wear a white polyester three-piece suit with a black shirt opened halfway to the navel.
Disco dancing?
Yes, but disco dancing specifically like whom?
Like John Travolta?
Exactly right. Dance like John Travolta. Women like nothing better than a man confident enough to strut his stuff Travolta style on the dance floor.
You know, I've really been suspect of some of the studies that you guys mentioned. Where did you get that study? Was it done by Mr. Cotter's class?
It must be true. We read about it on the internet.
Yeah. This is my problem.
I think it was funded by the John Travolta Sexual Attraction Foundation.
Yes.
You know, the San Diego Travolta Institute is a respectable organization. And they've proved many, many interesting scientific points over the years. This is just one of them.
Name another.
Another is that angels probably look like John Travolta. It's scientific fact.
So what the researchers did was they showed video clips of 15 different dance moves to women, and they asked their opinion about which is the most sexy, attractive, and they went for the John Travolta doing the hustle disco dancing from Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah, but you made it sound like when a guy's in a bar. Carl, I'm going to ask for a judgment here. I thought you made it sound like when a person was in a bar, what a man would do that would attract a woman. I got to tell you, if a man is in a bar and he gets up and begins to dance like John Travolta
to Lynyrd Skynyrd,
I think, okay, let me just say, there's so many factors that can't be controlled here. what bar? Yeah, is it?
I think the distinction is that I would be highly suspect of a man who walked up to me wearing a three-piece white polyester suit. However, if someone actually had some good moves but was not wearing a three-piece white polyester suit, I might be more impressed.
You guys, have you seen Saturday Night Fever recently?
No.
It doesn't hold up that well. I don't know what we were on in the late 70s.
Well, I read a study that says it holds up very well.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thanks, everybody. So to produce this week's show, we reached out to you on Twitter, on Facebook, and on the street, which, by the way, we hereby promise never to do again, and we absolutely swear we didn't mean anything by it.
We asked you what you remembered from our last few years of shows, and the answers as they came in tended to focus on the same handful of segments.
Which makes us ask, you know, what's the rest of the show, Chop Liver? I mean, like, we had a really nice interview with Larry King once. You guys didn't even mention it. It was charming. He told a joke and everything.
Fine. We're okay with whatever you choose. It turns out that many of you are music fans.
Well, if you were music fans, then you would not have asked to hear this Bluff the Listener game from December of 2008 with panelists Tom Baudette, Roxanne Roberts, and Paula Poundstone.
Hi, this is Mike Gray from Waco, Texas.
Hey, Mike, how are things in Waco?
They're actually cold, believe it or not.
Yeah, well, it gets that way. Well, Mike, it's nice to have you with us. You're going to play our game in which you must tell truth from fiction. Carl, what is Mike's topic?
Go ahead, Jack Frost. Just try and nip at my nose.
Are you tired of Santa? Do you see a red nose and want to paint it black? Well, we know just the thing to rekindle that Christmas glow. Each of our panelists will tell you about a new adorable holiday character that's been introduced this year in order to spread a particular brand of holiday cheer. Choose that real story. You'll win Carl Castle's voice on your home answering implement. Ready to play?
Yes, sir.
First up, let's hear from Roxanne Roberts.
Once a minor character in The Night Before Christmas, Vixen is now the spokes reindeer for a new Christmas campaign to prevent bad boob jobs. The animated Vixen, sporting a red and green bikini and bodacious curves, is the poster girl for the California Association of Certified Plastic Surgeons, which has launched PSAs and billboards promoting responsible cosmetic procedures. Quote, every December, husbands and boyfriends buy bargain basement breast augmentation for the women in their lives, explained Association Chair Dr. Steve Cohen. We wanted to educate them in a festive way. In the 32nd spot, Vixen says, quote, Santa knows who's naughty and nice and who's sexy. If plastic surgery is on your wish list, make sure you're in the right hands, a certified professional.
Vixen, the sea cup reindeer. Your next story of a new kid on the Christmas block comes from Paula Poundstone.
The GM in-house magazine Motormouth carried a Christmas story last week to explain the auto company's peril to little ears. Sparky, the little car maker's Christmas wish. Sparky was a chief executive office of a major car company. The company was a magical place with lots of workers who put together big, big cars that they had such fun making and that took lots of gasoline, glug, glug. People loved to drive them. The big, big cars went like hotcakes. Then one day, gas prices went way, way up, and nobody wanted to buy Sparky's cars anymore. He couldn't pay the workers. The spending money in the whole world started to go away. So the brave little CEO went into his big airplane and flew to the North Pole to ask the Christmas elves for a $25 billion loan. But the elves had no Christmas spirit, and they sent Sparky away. He was so sad. He knew the economy of the whole world depended on his company. So he drove back in his big, big car, glug, glug, and he wrote them a note dotted with tears and put it under their tree. Dear elves, all right, I'll take only $15 billion for my company and only give me a dollar.
Aww. Sparky, the auto company CEO, and his Christmas journey. Your last story of a new kid in the Christmas block comes from Tom Baudet.
The American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity, ACCCE, or ACC, this week unveiled their new holiday mascot, Frosty the Coal Man, in a nationwide effort to promote their oxymoronic, not really an alternative fuel. The rollout on their website features animated, bug-eyed lumps of coal singing this catchy number. Frosty the Coal Man is a jolly, happy soul. He's abundant here in America, and he helps our economy roll. Frosty the Coal Man's getting cleaner every day. He's affordable and adorable, and he helps workers keep their pay. There must have been some magic in clean coal technology, for when they look for pollutants, there was nearly none to see. Everybody sing, Frosty
the Coal Man. I applaud your Christmas spirit, everyone. All right. Mike, let me review your choices for you. From Roxanne, Vixen, the augmented reindeer. From Paula Poundstone, Sparky, the auto CEO. Or from Tom Baudet, Frosty, the coal man. Which of these is the real story of a new holiday character to warm you on those cold, long nights?
Well, I'm going to have to go with the coal, Frosty the Coal Man. That just sounds so ridiculous, but there's so much stuff going on here in Central Texas with coal.
Right. You wouldn't put it past them. Is that what you're saying?
No, I wouldn't.
All right.
No, I wouldn't.
Well, to bring you the correct answer, we can do nothing better than simply bring you this.
Frosty the Coal Man.
That is catchy. That, of course, was the Frosty the Coal Man jingle from the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity. Congratulations, Mike, you got it right. Well done. You're into points for Tom. You've won our prize. Carl Castle will record the greeting on your home answering machine. Well done, sir.
It was a pleasure.
If you grew up in the classic movie musicals of the 50s, or if you just discovered them, you probably were amazed to see that Mrs. Partridge was in so many of them.
Shirley Jones had an amazing career before starring in The Partridge Family, and she came on to talk about it with panelists Roxanne, Charlie, and Maz back in October of 2013.
And now the game where people who've done amazing things for a long time do something very bizarre for a short while. It's called Not My Job. Shirley Jones starred in some of the great movie musicals of the 1950s, Oklahoma, Carousel, The Music Man. She won an Oscar along the way. And then she went on to be the mother in the classic sitcom, The Partridge Family. She's written a new memoir. She joins us now. Shirley Jones, welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Your story, I'm not going to say you didn't deserve it, but you had one of the easiest rises to fame I've ever heard of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so tell me what happened.
Well, you know, I wanted to be a veterinarian. I was an only child in a small town in Smithton, Pennsylvania, adored animals, raised everything in the world, you know, and decided that was going to be what I was going to do. But I could sing. You know, it was given to me. It was a gift. And
yeah.
I thought everybody could sing. And so I would sing everywhere and be, you know, went to the Pittsburgh Playhouse and did some drama and dancing and so forth. Still wanted to be a vet. Went to New York on my way to college and went to an audition for Rodgers and Hammerstein I sang for the casting director, and he said, I'd like you to sing for Mr. Rogers. And I didn't even know who Richard Rogers was then.
Right.
I was 18, and he came down the aisle, and he said, Miss Jones, and I said, what'd you say your name was again? He said, Richard Rogers, never to forget that moment. I sang for him, and he said, would you wait? I'm going to call my partner, Oscar Hammerstein. I waited, and my pianist had to leave, and so he said, don't worry, we'll figure something out. Well, there was a symphony across the street, and he said, Miss Jones, you could come over and sing with the symphony for Oscar Hammerstein. I'd never heard a symphony, seen one, or sang with one, certainly.
So you walk into New York, you're there on a college trip.
Exactly right.
You go in on audition on a lark, and the next thing you know, you're singing for Rodgers and Hammerstein,
right,
the guys themselves, with a symphony orchestra.
Right.
And I want the kids out there who are thinking about a career in show business, that's how it works for pretty much everybody.
Not really, but...
And you went into one of their shows in New York, but
I went into South Pacific the last 3 months of the Broadway show, and then they sent me to California to screen test for the role of Laurie in Oklahoma, and that's what happened.
And so the next thing you know, now you're 21, and you were playing the lead in the musical mm-hmm. adaptation of the biggest musical in American history.
Mm-hmm.
Again, pretty much standard. I love the fact that you also tell in the book that... that Richard Rogers became first in a long line of show businessmen to hit on you.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, he asked me up to his office, and I was sitting there, and he put his arm around me, and then I suddenly saw him go and lock the door, you know, in the office, and came over, put his arm around me again, and he said, you have a boyfriend? And I said, oh, yes, I'm engaged. Of course, that was not true. I said, I'm engaged. He's waiting for me. And he said, oh, really? Well, it's too bad. You won't be there for a long time. I said, I know. And I said, well, you know, I'm so thrilled to be here. And I said, the fact that I have a wonderful grandpa right next to me.
Oh! Harsh. What did he do?
He said, oh, okay.
I mean, and then you were on the set of the movie and Rod Steiger hits on you?
Yeah, a little bit.
So one of the stories I loved about you after all that story is like you actually had one co-star who wouldn't kiss you, even on screen.
Well, Pat Boone.
Well, there you are.
Of course. And guess what? We just did a thing together, Pat and I. They did a screening of April Love at the Egyptian Theater, and they, you know, the two of us were invited. And we were sitting together doing a Q&A for the audience, and he leaned over and he said, Shirley, I'm going to do something that I promised I would do for the rest of my life. He pulled my face around and he kissed me flat on the lips.
Did he?
Yes.
So he had been regretting it ever since that moment.
That's what he said.
All right, I have to ask you, Shirley Jones, was it worth the wait?
Really,
it was.
Mm-hmm.
It was everything you dreamed of back
yes.
in the set.
Yes.
Now, another generation, I guess this includes my generation, first heard of you from the Partridge Family. This was a sitcom in which you played the mother of a traveling musical family.
Right.
And you played the mother of the lead singer was played by your...
David Cassidy, my stepson.
Your stepson.
Right.
Which must have been a little odd.
Well, not at all, no.
Oh.
No, I was the first person cast, and they came to me and said, Shirley, how do you feel about your stepson, David Cassidy? And I said, why? And they said, we're thinking of him to play, you know, the role in the show. So I said, he'd be perfect for it. That's great. And they said, oh, good. We want to make sure you have a good, you know, a good feeling about him.
Yeah.
I said, of course. Well, I was the first person cast, and I went on the set, and they were testing him. And I was on the set, and he turned around, and he saw me. He said, what are you doing here? I said, I'm your mama.
I wanted to ask about this because we were actually looking at clips, and there's you playing the piano and obviously singing. We know you can sing. Were you really playing the piano?
No, of course not.
And, well, I don't know. And then you had these other children.
Nobody played in the show.
Well, I have to say, I was going to ask.
Nobody did. And nobody sang in the show except David and me.
It was the least convincing lip syncing I have ever seen.
I mean, well, I know. You know, when we had recording sessions, you know, David did the recording. I was there doing the backup, basically.
Yeah.
And in 5 years of doing the show, I had two solos in the show.
That seems like a waste to me. You, and then, of course, David Cassidy, who played your son, your stepson in real life, became a huge teen idol.
Huge, huge teen idol.
That, and then your other son, Sean Cassidy.
Yes, became another teen idol.
That must have been odd.
It was very odd, yes.
What is it like to have sons who become international sex symbols for 14- and 15-year-olds?
Well, for me, you know, I mean, I was one of these mothers that said, you got to go to college, kids. You got to be a doctors and lawyers. Forget the damn show business. But when Dave, when it happened to David, Sean looked at me and he said, Ma, listen, if he can do it, I can do it. And literally walked out the door and did it.
Wow. So I knew you, like, again, in these wonderful innocent roles. I never got around to Elmer Gantry somehow. And then, of course, the Partridge Family. We were playing a sweet all-American mom. And I'm reading your book. And your book has, shall we say, a lot of adult material.
I know. Well, that's the point. When they came to me and asked if I would write a book about my life, I thought, do I want to do this? I mean, then I thought to myself, why not? I mean, if they know me as you know, Oklahoma Carousel, Mrs. Partridge, all those characters, why can't they know me as me? And I thought, I want to tell people who I am, the life that I had as a child, being married all my life. I mean, you know, I never had affairs with a lot of men. That was not my case. But I was very devoted to the two husbands I've had.
And your devotion led you to do some very interesting things,
That's
which you describe
exactly
in detail.
Absolutely.
Everything you're saying makes perfect sense, and you have every right, and even an obligation, to let your public know who you really are and what
Absolutely.
Your life was like.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I did not want to think about marrying the librarian getting freaky. That's so... there's... Now I have to, you know?
But of course. It's called life.
Yes, I guess so. Anyway, Shirley Jones, we're delighted to talk to you, and we've invited you here to play a game that this time we're calling...
Look, it's the Partridge Family.
Okay.
Get them.
So you played a partridge on the Partridge Family, as we've discussed.
That's
but
right.
We missed the episode where rich people stalked you with dogs and tried to shoot you with shotguns.
Oh.
Partridge shooting is a big sport, especially in England.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to ask you three questions about the sport of partridge shooting. Get two right, you'll win our game. Carl, who is Shirley Jones playing for?
Shirley is playing for Junette Sheen of Los Angeles, California.
All right. Ready to play?
Yes.
All right. First question. You begin. If you're a partridge shooter, if you are what is known as a gun, that's what they call you.
Yes.
You begin your day with a ritual known as what? A, the peg draw. B, the partridge cartridge. Or C, the ritual sacrifice to Moloch.
C.
The ritual sacrifice to Moloch. I love the idea of British aristocrats and tweeds with broken shotguns worshiping at the great idol of the Babylonian god Moloch.
Right.
That's, you sound very confident here. It's the peg draw is what it was.
Oh.
Your peg is your... Yeah, your peg, you see, is the place in line where you stand with your gun and you draw to see where you will stand.
I see.
All right.
Okay.
You still have two more chances. So if you go in your shoot, if you are a gun on a partridge shoot, you will be assisted by a person known as a what? A, Lord High Executioner. B, the stuffer. Or C, the fluffer.
B,
the stuffer. You're right. Very good. The stuffer is also known as the loader. He loads a fresh shotgun and hands it to you so you never miss a chance to kill
right.
a bird. All right. This is very exciting. You got one right with one to go. If you get this last one right, you will win. What does the well-appointed gun wear on his day on the line of shooting partridges? A, a flexible pair of breeks. B, a sporty funicular. Or C, a wide-brimmed uvula.
Oh. Pair of breeks.
You're going to go for pair of breeks?
Mm-hmm.
You're right, a pair of breeks.
Nice.
Breeks? Breeks are the terms for the special shooting trousers that guns
right.
wear. Carl, how did Shirley Jones do in our quiz?
Pretty good, Peter. She got two right, and that's good enough to win for Junette Sheen.
Shirley Jones is a star of stage and screen and has been for decades. Her book, Shirley Jones, A Memoir, is out now. Get it, read it. You will never forget it. Shirley Jones, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl, and thanks, everybody. Apparently, you listeners like your political operatives to be folksy and sharp-tongued, not to mention sharp-nosed,
sharp-lipped, sharp everything else, James Carville looks in person like kissing him would require stitches.
So we just talked to him when we went to Baton Rouge in the fall of 2013, and you all, as you might say, wanted to hear it again.
And now the game where those who are successful at something important try not to fail at something stupid. James Carville is a political consultant, a TV pundit, and one half of the most famous mixed marriage in the country, along with Republican consultant Mary Matlin. He is a proud graduate of LSU here in Baton Rouge. And we are pleased to have him here. James Carville, welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Well, wait, don't tell me.
So this whole Ragin' Cajun thing you've got going, not an act. You're from around here, right?
Yeah, oh, well, God, but God, my mother's from Evolves Parish, which is famous because the sheriff once spent time in his own jail.
Did he really?
Yeah. A legendary man named Potch Didier was the sheriff and he was sentenced to jail. He spent time in his own jail in Evolves.
I'm sure that made some unusual around here, only in that he was caught.
Yeah, he was caught. He probably made a mistake or two along the way, you know. And I grew up about 20, 25 miles south of here, right on the river.
Right.
Yes.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Carville, Louisiana.
You grew up in Carville, Louisiana?
I did.
Is everybody here from a town with the same name as they are?
Well, actually, what happened was is it used to be called Island, and my great-grandmother was the postmistress, and my grandfather was the postmaster. And the mail kept getting mixed up, so the post office named it Carville after him. And my daddy was the postmaster, so I come from a long line of bureaucrats.
I see. So how did you came here to Baton Rouge, went to LSU?
I did. I went for about 13 years or so.
Yeah.
I loved it.
we should say that that's because you also went to the law school as well.
I did, and I had I went to the Marine Corps, I took a little break, and I had some difficulties with my grades sometimes.
Did you really?
Well,
I mean, was it so hard for you at LSU that you thought the Marine Corps would be an easier time?
Well, I had to balance, you know, the French Quarter and the Bengal and the Tiger and the Cotton Club, and there was a lot of temptations around here.
I can imagine.
Peter, I have a question. So when you came from Carville to the, I guess Baton Rouge would be the big city.
Was it
mind blowing? How did you relate to that?
I grew up like 25 miles south of here. But when I came to LSU, I went to Catholic school, and then I came to LSU, and you just the visuals for a guy like me were stunning.
There you
know?
Go. Yeah.
And I didn't call much. I didn't say no to much. I pretty much took the whole thing in.
Yeah, you weren't saving yourself for
No, none of that stuff. Huh?
You weren't preserving your virtue in any way.
I always joke with my children. I tell them that, you know, Daddy had a 4.0 on graduation day, and they go, "Oh, Dad, you did?" And I said, "Sure, I did. It was my blood alcohol level."
So if I understand the story, you came back from the Marine Corps, you became a lawyer in Baton Rouge with your law degree.
Yeah, that's a rough definition of what I was. Yeah. But I did. I went to law school and I passed.
Well, you became well-known to the American public, not just because of the Clinton campaign in 1992, where you helped him get elected president,
right,
but also the movie that came out, The War Room, that kind of made you into a celebrity. Well, what was it like in those early days working with Clinton? I mean, before he became, you know, Bill Clinton as we all know him now.
I went to work, and the next thing you know, Jennifer Flowers, and then we had the draft story, and then we had this. I mean, we kind of went from one crisis to another, but then we'd go up to New Hampshire, like you're talking about Vermont. It was so cold. This is a true story.
How cold was it?
I will tell you how cold it was.
Please do.
I tell you. So the people from Arkansas were up there, and they decided that they were going to roast a pig. They love pigs in Arkansas, you know, razorbacks. And it was so cold, the fire couldn't thaw the pig.
Since 1992, you spent most of your time working as a consultant for campaigns in foreign countries.
Yes.
How can that be possible? How can a guy from Carville, Louisiana, say, working in an Israeli election?
Well, I figured the secret out in an Israeli election. We had to concentrate on a Jewish vote.
Oh, yeah, that's very important. Because I'm coming
in. Say, you know, if you didn't do that, you weren't going to win, huh? Actually, I did a race in Nigeria one time. I said, now, we got to get the blacks for us. You understand? We've got to target this important group here.
And that's how you earn your money.
That's yeah. it. But that kind of insight yeah, you just don't get anywhere, man.
James Carville, we are delighted to talk to you. We have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
You're like two peas in a pod.
Okay. You famously have a mixed marriage, Democrat and Republican, hairless and haired. But it turns out there are a lot of couples who are very much alike, maybe even too alike. And we're going to ask you three questions
All right.
about freakishly similar couples. Get two right, and you'll win our prize from one of our listeners, Carl's voice and their voicemail. Carl, who is James Carville playing for?
James Carville is playing for Ann Edelman of Baton Rouge.
All right.
Oh, God.
Come up through here. Come up through here. All right, first question. Here we go. So if you want to find someone to date who looks like you, you have some options, such as which of these? A, body type theme nights at your local TGI Fridays, such as Ectomorph Night. B, find your facemate, a website that lets you upload a photo so it finds automatically someone who looks like you that you can then date. Or C, just attend any comic book convention.
What is the second one?
The second one is you go to findyourfacemate.com. You can upload a picture, and its algorithm finds other people who've uploaded pictures that look like you.
I'll go with two.
You're going to go with two? You're right. That's the one. Find your facemate.
That's a good sign. We're going to beat Georgia. Oh, yeah.
Very good. Very good. Okay. Next question. Donald and Nancy Featherstone are famous for having worn matching clothes every day for the last 33 years. Shirts, suits, pajamas, everything. They make them themselves. But that is not the Featherstones' only claim to fame. How else have they made their mark? A, Donald Featherstone invented the pink plastic lawn flamingo. B, Nancy Featherstone has won the Coney Island hot dog eating contest 6 times. Or C, they met when he ran her over with his Zamboni machine.
Again, I'm going with logic again. C.
You're going to go for C. Wait a minute. Logic leads you.
Well, more logical. See, it went to Coney Island because it's somebody from Japan that wins it every year.
Yeah. Okay. So you're going to go for the Zamboni.
I'm going to go for the Zamboni.
No. Although that would have been awesome. He's riding along and he feels a bump and he looks back and she's frozen in the ice and he says, how beautiful. No, it was actually A, Donald Featherstone invented the pink flamingo.
Oh.
Back in 1957.
All right.
In his first year out of art school. That's okay because you got one more to go. If you get this, you win. All right. This is the deciding vote. Here we go. Husband and wife Michael Roach and Christy McNally were very much in love, so when they got married in 1998, they decided to do what? A, never swallow a piece of food that hadn't been first chewed by the other. B, never be more than 15 feet from each other, ever. Or C, never speak except in unison.
B is what?
B is never be more than 15 feet from each other.
B.
You're going to go for B, never be more than 15 feet from each other?
Yes.
You're right. That's how they did it. They were
I
never,
am pumped. I'm pumped.
They did it. They did it. They stayed within 15 feet of each other all day, all night, every day, every night. And their marriage was very happy until they got divorced in 2010.
Wow.
So, Carl, how did James...
I got to tell you one thing.
Tell me one thing.
They didn't eat a lot of beans.
No, I didn't. Or they didn't mind.
Did they really get divorced?
They really did.
Goes why?
Why? They wanted their space, I guess. They decided to go in a different direction. I don't know. Carl, how did James Carville do in our show?
James had 2 correct answers, Peter, so he wins for Ann Edelman. Congratulations.
Well done. James Carville is a professor of political science at Tulane University. His latest book, Love and War, co-authored with his wife, Mary Madden, will be out in January. James Carville, thank you so much for being on Wait, Don't Tell Me. Thank you so much.
He said,
I say either, you say neither, and I say neither, either, either, and either, neither. Let's call the whole thing off. Yes, you like potato.
I like. Sometimes fiction is stranger than truth. And that seems to have happened with a game you wanted to hear again. It's from August of 2008 with panelists Roxanne Roberts, Charlie Pierce, Paula Poundstone, and guest judge and scorekeeper Corey Flintoff.
Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hey there, Peter.
Hey, who's this?
This is Jim Stotts from Conroe, Texas.
Conroe, Texas. Where the heck is that?
That is one county north of Houston.
Can you smell Houston from there?
Unfortunately, sometimes, yeah. There's a prevailing southerly breeze here. Yeah,
that's great. Well, that's nice, though. A little whiff of Houston in the morning. Well, welcome to the show, Jim. Now, you are going to play the game in which your job is to tell truth from fiction. Corey, what is Jim's topic?
If I find Andrew Weil, I'm going to rip out his beard one hair at a time.
Wow. So everybody is constantly offering us advice on how to live more healthily. Let's be honest, a lot of this stuff will not help at all. In fact, some of it is downright bad for you. Our panelists are going to tell you about three stories that clearly illustrate the unexpected dangers of healthy living. We found it in this week's news. Choose that real story. You'll win Carl's voice on your home answering machine. Ready to play?
I'll give it a try.
All right. First up, let's hear from Roxanne Roberts.
British celebrity chef Anthony Worrell Thompson had a fantastic recommendation. Henbane, he said in August's Healthy and Organic Living magazine, is, quote, great in salad. Really yummy. Unfortunately, henbane, an old Anglo-Saxon term meaning killer of hens, happens to be a very toxic weed that causes hallucinations, drowsiness, seizures, and possibly even death. Thompson meant, of course, to say fat hen, a safe wild herb used for tea and salads. He told the BBC the mix-up was, quote, embarrassing, but one of those genuine mistakes. No reports of any casualties yet, but the magazine has posted a warning on its website. As always, check with an expert when foraging or collecting wild plants.
A lovely organic gathered salad that could kill you.
Ah.
Your next story of an unintended consequence of healthy living comes from Charlie Pierce.
The Broadway Pilates studio in Delafield, Wisconsin, was forced to destroy all its apparatus this week when students found themselves afflicted with a rash on the palms of their hands. Studio director Wendy Bendofsky mixed up a batch of moss-based organic cleanser from an old Native American regime, only to find that it reacted virulently with the material in the equipment causing the rash. Now all students have to wash their hands thoroughly under the supervision of the studio staff after each session, prompting Bendofsky to joke that the studio will change its name to Pontius Pilates.
Poisoned Pilates equipment in Wisconsin. Your last story of bad juju from too much tofu comes from Paula Poundstone.
Just say no to tea tree oil. Keith Richards was among the passengers on American Flight 72 from Boston Logan Airport to London Heathrow who got an unexpected free high despite the airline's recent cutback on perks. When she woke with a bit of congestion that morning, flight attendant Andrea Brandt applied Vicks VapoRub to her chest. Once at the airport, Ms. Brandt topped the VapoRub with tea tree oil, an herbal healing agent. This, investigators found, created an intoxicating aroma. Soon after takeoff, the fumes began to affect the passengers. It was a bit like heroin, really. It was slow and then bam, said Keith Richards. Pilot Jasper Byrne, secure within the cockpit, remained unaffected, but suspected something odd when strains of Beast of Burden reached him through the cockpit door. They were all singing. All I could think was, how am I going to get these buggers to put their seat backs forward, said Byrne. It was a bit like a hit of ecstasy, said Keith Richards. A jubilant group of 10 from business class donned their flotation devices and formed a conga line, chanting, cut the engines over the Atlantic. It was more sort of like a bit of Quaalude with a vodka chaser, kind of how the top of your head comes off, said Keith Richards. The flight landed safely at Heathrow.
really hard to come down, said Richards.
No, no, Paula, go on. All right.
Was my story a little long?
It was, but worth every second, Paula. Yeah. It was fabulous. Jim, let me review your choices for you from Roxanne Roberts, a story about how a chef in a Healthy Living magazine recommended that the readers poison themselves with ingredients for an organic salad. From Charlie Pierce, how a Pilates studio became a toxic waste dump through the use of an organic cleanser. Or from Paula Poundstone, the story of how a flight attendant's experiments with VapoRub and tea tree oil ended up pretty much sending the passengers on a trip they had not expected. Which of these is the real story in the news this week?
Wow, that Keith Richards is just a never-ending source of amusement.
Isn't he, though?
Yeah, but I'm going to choose answer A because the phrase that was used in that one, genuine mistake.
Genuine
British
mistake.
Accent sounds the most genuine.
All right, so you're going to choose Roxanne's story about the poisonous herb being recommended for use in salads. Well, we spoke to an authority in this area to bring you the truth.
We would never consider using henbane on a menu at Alinea. Yeah, it's fatal. Perhaps something like iodine.
That was Grant Ackett, who is the chef and owner of the award-winning restaurant Alinea right here in Chicago, who is explaining why he would do a lot of things, but he wouldn't put henbane in his salads because it's bad for you. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Jim, you picked the right answer. Roxanne was telling the truth.
Thank you.
You earned a point for Roxanne, which I know is your greatest pleasure in this life. And you've won our game. Carl Castle will record the greeting on your home answering machine. Congratulations. Well done.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives on the web at hewlett.org, the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness on the web at melvilletrust.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at macfound.org. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and WBEZ Chicago in association with Urgent Haircut Productions, Doug in a Hammock, Berman, Benevolent Overlord. Philip Godica writes our limericks. Our house manager is Don Hall. Our assistant house manager is Tyler Green. Our CFO is Andy Ann. Our intern is Stephen Tathias. Our web guru is Beth Novi. Engineers include Les Delarchik and Muhammad Mao. Thanks to John Zajac at Chase Bank. BJ Liedemann composed our theme. Our program is produced by Eva Walchover, Miles Dernboss, and Emily Ecton. Technical direction is from Lorna White. Our production coordinator is Robert Approbation Newhouse. Our senior producer is Ian Chillog. The executive producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Michael Danforth. Thanks to Carl Castle and to all our panelists and our fabulous guests you heard today. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Peter Sagal, and we will see you all next week. This is NPR.